This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
With the best comedy, it comes from a sense of moral clarity to some extent. And the best satire is a form of moral outrage, you know, sublimated into the shape of comedy.
Hello, welcome to the Klein Show on the Vox Media. So I just had the strangest conversation. I've wanted to have Dave Eggers on the show forever, for years. I've been fascinated by him for years. I read Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius when it came out, read a bunch of other novels, but like watching him over time, he created like the 826 series of pirate tutoring centers and McSweeney's and The Believer. Then he began writing these books, like What is the What? Where he was doing this reportage and very earnestly telling the story of other people's lives and the range of things he's done over time, The Circle. I'm just so fascinated by people who are able to stay creatively that alive and to start things that remain creatively that distinct. So I want to talk to him for years. And he's just bringing out a new book, a satire of Donald Trump called The Captain and the Glory. And so I got this chance. And I say this in the conversation. I came in this conversation, I'm kind of having a bad day. And feel fractured and all over the place and frustrated. And I was talking to him for a while. And it wasn't really clicking exactly at the beginning for me. I think like because my like mind is all racing. He's giving these like very thoughtful answers. And then at some point midway through, I just realized I've become completely hypnotized by the conversation. And I'm finding it incredibly calming. And it's really like landing with me. I don't know if you guys will all have the same emotional experience I did in this. But I really enjoyed this one, and particularly by the end, like was really hearing him. So maybe it's just me today, but I found it really hypnotic and really wise and calming. It was not the conversation I expected to have, a little bit more guru-like by the end. But I think there's a lot to learn from the way Dave Eggers looks at life, which was not what my questions had been ready for, but it's certainly where we went. So I don't know. I hope you all enjoy it as much as I did. As always, you can email me at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. If you want to send me calm, thoughtful ideas about who to interview on the show next. But here's Dave Eggers. And if this one takes a minute to click for you, just give it a little bit of time. It did for me, but it was really worth it. Dave Eggers, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I've admired the range of things you do forever. And I was trying to think of where to start this, which turned out to be intimidating for that reason. So let me begin here. Of everything you've started, created, written, done, what are you most proud of?
Oh, God. I never have a good answer for the most this or I resist these things, I got to say. I will say that last night we had a fundraiser here in New York. I'm just visiting New York for a few days, but we had a fundraiser celebrating the 15th year of 826 New York, which is like an offshoot of our Pirate Supply Tutoring Center there in the Mission District of San Francisco. And the center's been around in San Francisco almost 20 years. And so it's really bizarre to think of how, you know, a few decades go by and through the help of a lot of other people and volunteers and executive directors and board members, all these people, these ideas persist. And so I'm sure you'll appreciate this too in 15 years with, you know, and look back and might be somebody else running Vox. I don't know. But and you'll be sitting on a beach somewhere in Bermuda, maybe not Bermuda, but you'll be able to look back and sort of appreciate not just starting something, but giving it to other people to run better. At least that's how it is in my
case. I stepped down as editor-in-chief, I guess over a year ago now, or maybe even more than that. And now it's out there being run better, and I get to do fun podcast interviews.
Isn't that the thing?
It's hard to de-individuate, though, if that's a word, right? Are you able to put things down that you started?
Yeah, what I do, like McSweeney's is run by infinitely more talented people than me right now, and you know they have an incredible team. And every so often I'll have a notion, and I'll say, "What about this?" And they might run with it or might not, but. The main thing is just seeing it persist. These projects that you birthed on a whim, you know, 20 years ago are still around, and they mutate a little bit and they get personalized around the new people running them. But it's a real kind of, I feel like a, you know, weird grandfatherly love for these things to sort of be able to look back and see them grow up and, raised well by their new caretakers. And so I, you know, at the moment I'm thinking a lot about 826 and all the centers that have that have been spawned around the world. There's about 70 that are based on the model all over the world, and it's just it's a trip to think about.
Can you say what the model is? You offhandedly called it a pirate supply learning center. And I was in the one in DC a number of times. I've been to some of the others. Yeah. But I think that that as an offhanded description probably didn't make a ton of sense to people. So what is the model of 826?
Well, it started as an after school drop-in tutoring center. And McSweeney's rented a building in the Mission District, and we were in the back, and in the middle was a tutoring center where our staff tutored after school. And then in the front, because of a zoning obligation, we had to sell something. And so we came up with pirate supplies. And so we sold real Buccaneer supplies for like the working pirate. And so it's still this way. You go in there and there's like planks and peg legs and, you know, eye patches, and it's all real stuff. It's not like corny pirate tourist stuff. It's like for the, you know, the working buccaneer. And so, and that spawned, you know, the tutoring center turned into almost 2,000 tutors in San Francisco. And we send them into schools all over the Bay Area, and we work one-on-one with students and their writing, bring out their voices, polish their writing, try to empower them through the written word. And so we're sending tutors into schools all over the city. We're publishing their work, about 10,000 books that we've published over the last 20 years. And then we get them ready for college. So there's all kinds of college access programs. So it keeps growing and growing, and it spawned all of these sister centers around the world. And the second one that we started was here in Brooklyn, where I used to live. And that's, instead of a pirate store, they've got a crime-fighting store. So if you go to 5th and 5th in Brooklyn, you'll see the Brooklyn Superhero Supply Company. And it really looks like a Costco for crime fighters. But then there's a secret door that leads into the an unseen back room where there's a tutoring center. So they all have these like ludicrous fronts that kind of destigmatize the place where a lot of kids are going to get extra help.
So I'm now going to do a question set that's clearly going to overread this, but it's part of why I've always been really fascinated by your work. Irony and earnestness tend to be seen as in opposition to each other.
Right.
A lot of your early work was very drenched in irony and then has a sort of trap door into incredibly deep earnestness.
Yeah, well said. I like how you put that, yeah.
Well, yeah, I just took it from your thing. And so there's a way in which the 826s have always seemed a little bit like a metaphor for the work you do. And I think that was something that has always struck me about your writing, that a lot of people will do a number of things, but they're all functionally the same thing. And I think I'm in some ways even an example of that myself. But when you went from doing things like heartbreaking work and memoir into these very straight books about a life somebody else lived, it was very different from your own. It was not experimental, you know, like with What Is the What and the books about teachers and Smollett and, I'm sorry, Yemeni immigrants in SF who've like gotten very deeply involved in the coffee trade, that was a transition in tone that I don't see many writers or even people make. And I'm curious how you saw those things fitting together, like how that transition happened.
Well, you know, what was weird was that the memoir was the anomaly, because I went to journalism school in downstate Illinois and taught by old Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times reporters and editors. And I worked at the Daily Paper every day my 4 years down there. So I was a, you know, news reporter and features reporter and human interest reporter and editor and edited a magazine. And then after, you know, in most of my 20s, I was, you know, I was a working journalist for weeklies and websites. And I mean, I did cartooning too. I did all kinds of stuff, but a lot of it was, or most of it was pretty straight. And so I had a sense of humor and I appreciated that. And I think I took a gimlet eye to a few or a lot of topics. But, you know, when I wrote that memoir, it was a little bit of a left turn from where I had been, you know, most of my work up till that point. And so then after that, when I went back to telling, you know, more or less, I mean, sometimes very straight stories about other people, that was my roots as a writer for a newspaper. You were telling stories and you're finding stories and trying to illuminate a life for an issue that hasn't been explained or explained well enough. And I see that as my goal most days when I wake up now. And the tone and I think the archness of the memoir is sometimes a little tough on my eyes and ears to look at now. It's a tone that I think I took on maybe for a couple of years maybe, and it's not really, wasn't really the essence of, I don't know. I mean, I guess like anybody's younger work, it makes you cringe on certain pages, and then other things you can appreciate from a certain distance. But yeah, the range of work since is a little bit more, you know, true to, I'm just digging myself in the most mushy, inarticulate hole here.
Well, everybody's history is hard to parse. I'm not going to make you hold in heartbreaking work, because I think that things people did a long time ago they're just strange to revisit. But the one question I do have about the tone is that it's always seemed to me it was hugely influential in how a lot of internet writing began happening. That if you look at things like early Gawker and All and other things, that there's a real lineage back to heartbreaking work and other things coming out at that moment. And I'm curious if you think that's true.
I wouldn't give any credit to my book. I think it was in the water at that time. There was a certain sarcasm. The term irony even, I think, is so ill-defined and so amorphous and so, I think, often misunderstood. I think you could, and when I was growing up in Chicago, we just called it sarcasm, you know, and then we grew up with Letterman, who really kind of elevated or perfected the form, I guess. And that was our sense of humor. That was everyone I know. And so it didn't seem unique. We thought that was humor. Humor was sarcasm or a little bit of a cynical take, I guess, on anything seeming smushy or even new, or everything about California, for example, you know, we thought was very funny. And so it was everywhere. And it seeped into a lot of the literature of the time. And then, of course, The Onion came about in the 90s. And I think that was, you know, for the internet, even though it was a certain kind of strict format of fake news, I think that was like the most influential use of the English language on the web, at least in the early days. At least that's how I take it.
This is the way I would push that, which is I think it's not quite right to say this was all sarcasm and even irony, because I think of that, you know, take the Letterman example or even the Onion example. It's very detached. It's at reserve. And what has always struck me as interesting about a lot of the internet, the way the internet twisted that in a lot of the early blogging, is it's sarcastic, it's cynical, but it's very immediate. The eye is very much in there, right? If you like look at Gawker, it's confessional. It's like exclamation points. It's new journalism. It's like ironic. It's sarcastic new journalism in a way that has always felt like a pretty big difference.
Ah, well, I mean, I have to admit, I don't know anything about Gawker, I'm afraid. I know what they did, and I just didn't read it. So I'm afraid I'm speaking out of ignorance. I just know them conceptually as a thing. But you know what was weird, though, and this comes up like a lot when you talk about humor and certain types of humor, or if you call it ironic humor or cynical or sarcasm, and it's still, you know, it's exemplified to some extent by Jon Stewart and the talk show host now. And what was especially acute with Letterman in his later days was that he was a patriot, and he was like somebody that cared a lot about the future of this country, you know? And I think that when you started seeing him giving, you know, pretty tough interviews to political candidates and presidents and asking questions that other people weren't, and the fact that it was being done by a so-called comedian made it a little bit more poignant, and I think it tricked a lot of politicians onto his show, thinking it was going to be an easy ride, and then he would put questions to them in kind of a very Midwestern, commonsensical, kind of straight-talking way. And I think that there's, with the best comedy, it comes from a sense of moral clarity to some extent. And the best satire is a form of moral outrage, you know, sublimated into the shape of comedy. And I think Letterman and, I don't know, all of my sort of comic heroes, whether it was Monty Python or Letterman or Jon Stewart or The Onion, all have a deep subterranean current of the most sincere kind of hopes for the future of the human race. You know, you find it in Vonnegut too, and Vonnegut might be, you know, the godfather of it all, maybe Twain, I don't know, but I've been rereading a lot of Vonnegut lately and just seeing how profoundly he was a moralist and had no problems with explaining his moral point of view and allowing his outrage for our foibles and frailties and failures to come through.
That's actually, I was planning to get this a bit later, but it's a good bridge to The Captain and the Glory, which is a satire. But I kept thinking, reading it, that it showed something weird about this era, which is I often think of satire as amplifying or highlighting sort of subtle things that are operating like right on the edge of our consciousness, things that are like nobody's saying or hard to say or hard to grasp. And so you blow it up into the satire, right? You heighten its contradictions. But like, we're in this era where there is no subtlety. Like, everything is right there. Like, the guy just says it all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, what is the role of satire? When you sat down to write that, like, what were you trying to do or show that you felt was being missed in just his tweets every day?
I think that we obviously were so close to it every day, and there isn't ever a break to take a look and take a few steps back and make any sense of this, because there's a new outrage or a new degradation or a new low every day, and we are inherently distracted, and our attention spans are just as bad as scientists and everybody else would say. And we cannot stay on a topic for more than a few days. And the fact that we've even stuck with impeachment for whatever it is, 5 weeks or so now, is astonishing, because all of the other crimes misdemeanors committed by this president have sort of come and gone. And even though dozens, if not hundreds of them are impeachable, I think if you fit them into the purposely loose definition of high crimes and misdemeanors. But satire can take a step back and distill things and tell a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end, most importantly, because we're not in the middle of an end yet. We don't know how this is going to turn out. But the luxury of satire is to say, okay, I'm going to eliminate 90% of the noise. I'm going to concentrate on a handful of characters, on a much smaller version of our 320 million people, just a few thousand representatives sitting on a, living on a boat. And all of those kind of tools allow you to, you know, see things or tell a clearer, simpler, but no less complex story. And ideally, by sort of making it a little bit clearer and getting rid of the a little bit of the clutter, you can illuminate some truths that are right under our nose.
You've talked a lot about empathy as being at the core of a lot of your work and a lot of your projects. And is there a tension between the empathy of a lot of political reporting and just the outrage of trying to pull away the clutter and just see things that are wrong clearly and make people see them as wrong as opposed to see them as nuanced or somehow the product of bigger forces?
Thank you. That's, you said, this has been the problem for the last 3 years for me, is that I've been covering Trump and I've been going to rallies and going to KKK and anti-KKK rallies. And I've been writing a lot of long-form journalism for The Guardian especially, but for other venues. And every time I go to one of these rallies, I meet very reasonable people who I like, who are at the rallies. Some of them are just going because it's a free ticket. We always forget these rallies are free. So that's why there's a lot of people there. It is free entertainment. So, and I meet the people and I say, you know, are you a Trump voter, yes or no? And why, you know, what do you think about this? And do you have reservations about that? And invariably, their intelligence is, it's nuanced. Their beliefs are complex. They have reservations. They don't like everything Trump does, but they do like this or that policy. And very often they're voting out of narrow self-interest or one issue alone. And I have the best conversations. And I always come away from these rallies thinking, all right, we'll be okay because all of these people are reasonable and their thinking is changeable, I think. And if they are offered even a few of these issues, you know, addressed by another candidate from another party, they can be moved because, and maybe for a candidate that, you know, for whom they don't have so many reservations. So I come away thinking, all right, we'll be okay. And American people are good-hearted at the core, and my faith is always quickly restored. And then I spend a few days reading about the latest policy outrages, the suffering of people at the border, asylum seekers, refugees here and abroad, the real-world horrifying consequences of the rhetoric and the policies. And then I get outraged again. And I kick myself almost for forgiving the millions who put this person in office. And so I've had this sort of cycle for 3 years now where I like meeting everyone, you know, usually, and I understand and I have empathy for them. And then the fact that they tolerate the continuous and hard to deny degradation of the office of the president and the rule of law and the trampling of the Constitution and this just the idea of decency and dignity in D.C., then I find myself really, you know, some of that empathy is harder to access for until I meet them again, and then we have good conversations.
So what is your explanation?
What do you mean?
What squares the circle? Look, Donald Trump, say what you will about him, he's not hidden. Like, it's something I appreciate about him. He's very upfront about who he is. And in a way that is always striking to me, I know a lot of people, and I know a lot of Trump supporters. And universally, I think they are better people than he is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. The very first rally I went to was in Sacramento in before he was elected in August in 2016. And it was very obvious. This was the same crowd that would have been at a minor league baseball game. It was calm and every age. It was very diverse. It was farmers and urbanites and everybody in between. And and then the guy at the microphone was spouting, you know, both a lot of regular Trump humor, which every so often is actually pretty funny. He gave a very entertaining hour to these folks. But it was evident that the craziest person of the 3,000 or 4,000 people in that airplane hangar on a hot day in Sacramento was the guy at the microphone. And it's very strange that we are so okay, because they will all admit it too. Most Trump supporters do know and will quickly admit he's a madman, but he's their madman. And you know what struck me, and I don't know if you agree, but Trump has his own Trump, and that's Giuliani. He wanted somebody to stand up for him and fight like a dog and do whatever he said and, you know, bend a few rules. As long as he was loyal, fearless, and would get on TV and defend him to the death. And that's why he let Giuliani off the leash and do so much damage. But he would rather have a bold, fearless attack dog who made a lot of mistakes than he would a fearful or timid or, you know, practiced insider who wouldn't fight. And in a way, a lot of Trump's voters want, they don't care how mean, ugly, crude, ignorant he is, he's out there fighting, and or that he seems to be fighting. And it struck me as an interesting parallel that the same trait that a lot of voters wanted in and why they put him in office is why he was so loyal to Giuliani. And oddly enough, you know, this might be the linchpin to it all, and the reason that, well, certainly one of the many reasons he'll be impeached by the House, at least.
I want to go back to the question of supporters, though. And in some ways, I found that to be actually the most interesting part of Captain in the Glory, the kind of scenes where people are deciding whether or not to put this guy in charge of the boat.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, people are looking at somebody and they know they would not want their neighbor acting this way.
Yeah.
They wouldn't want their spouse acting this way. They wouldn't want their friend acting this way. They wouldn't want their boss acting this way. Are you kidding? And they decide to overlook it. And, you know, maybe some of it is like, the guy's a fighter, guy says what he believes, but there is something that is being reflected in society that is important. And I think that in one of the reasons I'm interested in having this conversation with you is that I think that there is a tendency, if you are in political journalism in the way I am, that you always want to like filter it through the like the material resources lens, right? It's got to be economic anxiety, or it's got to be it's got to be something we can translate into a policy, right? Like what we do in political punditry is we mash up what's happening in politics and like we like chew it up till it's in some form that we can digest. And so like everything goes through this filter till like we've like spit it back out in politics-y so like Congress can legislate on it.
Yeah.
But, like that's actually not how human beings operate. And so just on the like on the level of like human reaction, right? The dimension that novelists operate on. I'm curious what you see, what you think people are seeing when they look at this guy and say, that's not normal, but you know what?
Well, I think that the, you know, the science says that the main thing that runs throughout his supporters of all different socioeconomic classes and regions is a tendency toward authoritarianism. And I do think that that's true. Most of the people that I met that were reasonable and they would talk about how things were out of control before and they wanted some order and they wanted somebody to lay down the law and they wanted somebody that would tell it to them straight. Oh, and you realize that there is a hunger for simplicity, and a lot of people do not like the complexity of the three branches of government, how slowly things move, how hard it is to get things done, how much debate and blather to, you know, to hear them talk about it is, how much inaction there is. They really want the strong man every so often to lay down the law and get stuff done. And that is like really, I think almost more than anything, the thread that runs throughout, at least all of the supporters that I've met. And then there's the idea that he is the blonde famous man from TV. The most enlightening conversation I had was, I went to a rally in El Paso and Trump was speaking on one side of the street and Beto O'Rourke had his rally on the other side of the street. So I spent the day going between the two spots and interviewing people. I interviewed these two young t-shirt vendors, one African-American, one white woman, and then African-American guy. They've been traveling since Trump was a candidate together, selling stuff. And they were not millionaires selling t-shirts and hats at these rallies. But, and I said, well, do you guys have health insurance? No, we don't have health insurance. I said, okay, so, and what do you do if you get sick? Well, we go to the emergency room. I said, well, okay, so what would you say to maybe a 1% increase in taxes for the wealthiest Americans, millionaires and billionaires, and that might pay for your insurance? You know, you'd have Medicare, you'd have Medicare for all. And they both barely skipped a beat. They said, well, I don't know about that. That doesn't sound too good to me because I'm planning on being a millionaire. And when I'm a millionaire, I don't want my taxes increased. And you can imagine, like, think about that uniquely American way to think, A, you know, they're not seeing how that system works, how a little, you know, they think that they are, and this is the history of our country. Everybody thinks that they're on the edge, on the very verge of being a millionaire or a billionaire, and they see themselves in Trump. And they don't see that Trump is not working for their best interest. And they didn't see that George W. was not interested in their best interests, or their Republican policies as a whole are not necessarily helping them get healthy or are necessarily helping them get a college education, all of these different things. They see, though, that they might be in that spot with a few lucky breaks in the t-shirt vending business, maybe. And so they're thinking ahead. They don't want their future taxes on their millions to be raised. It's a diabolical and very strange mindset. And I say this about these two guys, man and woman I met that I had a 45-minute conversation. I loved talking to them, and they were such good people. But we have a real strange mentality in this country, and I guess we always have. But it amazes Europeans and anybody with any kind of social safety net when I tell stories like this, because it's very unique to us.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been podcast futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/gray area. That's greenlight.com/gray area to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/gray area.
So one of the things that I always find interesting about Trump is that he operates as a kind of pure id. He says things that most of us, even if we thought them, wouldn't say, certainly would not tweet. The amount of restraint I feel that I'm exercising on myself at every single moment of every single day is just this constant, exhausting,
modeling of what everybody outside of me is going to see when they look at me. Like, it's just like, it's horrible. And he operates in this way that is totally without it.
Remember when Dave Chappelle, when he was a candidate, Chappelle said he was admiring the fact that he just said his mind is free.
Yeah.
He has no, he just said, you got to admire that. His mind is free. And I thought, I don't know, probably butchered it, but it was a uniquely Chappellian observation.
But this is a way in which I think a paradox or a tension of this age is that the internet, the whole way we live our digital lives, for most of us, what it's created is an even more paralyzing sense of constant social evaluation. At the same time that in many ways it seems to prize people who are able to just totally let go of that and be free. And you were pretty early in writing The Circle, which is a much more dystopic take on Silicon Valley, which I think a lot of people caught up to a couple years later. And you've talked about this idea of situational internet madness, this thing where all of a sudden we exist in this world where the norms we had to help us cooperate are breaking. I'm curious whether or not you see like a bridge in those things, like whether or not you think Trump and some of the other things we're seeing are just like, this is just our society going through situational internet madness, and over time we'll figure it out.
Remember when Obama was called the first internet president because he tweeted, right? And you look it up, and I remember looking it up, you know, a few years ago after Trump was elected, and everyone, you know, there's all these articles about him being the first internet president. He wasn't at all the first internet president, because he was still, all of his messaging was done, you know, with a White House seasoned, reasonable, you know, vetted by 30 lawyers kind of style.
Yeah, remember, if he was the one who wrote a tweet, it would have his lowercase initials on it.
Right.
Like, that was their thing. The other ones were not him.
And even then, you know, as a lawyer, he was sending that through at least a handful of advisors and lawyers just to make sure, because this is going to be part of the historical record and it would have a lot of power. So, but Trump is really the first internet president. He is the manifestation of all the worst aspects of the internet. The speed of unreasonable judgment, the typos, the inability to spell anything correctly, the react before thinking, the weird vitriolic filter that somehow, like, the most reasonable people will turn into raging maniacs online, the way that it is just kind of an outrage machine. I think that Trump in person... I actually was just talking to somebody that had a lunch with him way back when. You know, he said, well, he's not without his charms, you know, like in person. And I think that his access to Twitter has been one of the real towering degradations of the office of the presidency, because otherwise, if he's giving a speech or if he's giving a press conference, even, you know, I think the at least the verbal and demeaning and embarrassing messaging that will always be part of the historical record, none of that would be there. I think you would have had like a tiny fraction of the shame that we live with, at least in terms of that his oratory and, I mean, you know, or his social media usage would be. If we took all that away, I think all of us would still be living through a very tough time, and his policies would still be in place. But I think some of the shame that we live with and the just incredible embarrassment would go away. But if you think about it, yeah, all of the internet madness that people succumb to when they use social media for whatever reason, I still have no idea, because we've all been guilty of it. Since the advent of email, I remember writing, you know, suddenly I'd get my dander up and be writing in all caps and saying things that I would never to say to anybody in person. And luckily, you know, we caught on, at least a lot of us, early enough to say, like, okay, this is a medium that has a weird power over us and it transforms us just by using it. And so ideally, most of us solve that in our 20s and use it without endangering ourselves or the idea of civility. But he is the uncensored id of the internet. And it was only a matter of time. I mean, in a way, it's if Black Mirror had been around 10 years ago and they wanted to create sort of some dystopian idea of what would be the worst electoral manifestation of how we use the internet, they would create this monster.
They absolutely would not. I think about this all the time. It would not in any way be believable. Like, it would just be,
well, they wouldn't do
such a ridiculous episode. One of the things Trump is able to do is, it's like a black hole of attention. Like, so I'm going to pull us off of him because I think it's a good Trump conversation, well, and I've wanted to talk to you for years.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. Like I call it the Trump trap door. It's like in any conversation, you're just walking along and like you fall right through and you're like, then the rest of your dinner is about Donald Trump. Like, we're just here for 4 hours talking about immigration, you know, horrors. But on the internet, you gave this great lecture at Penn that in terms of how it changes us, you told a story about a friend and an email read receipt that I thought was super perceptive. And I'd like you to retell it and explore that a bit with you.
Well, that happened in New York a lot of years ago.
To go to New York.
Yeah. Well, it was in the late 90s because I lived here a few years then. And so, you know, it was a reasonable friend of mine that we used to get together once a week for lunch. And anyway, he sent me an email one day. And I didn't read it. I looked at it, but I didn't answer it. That was it. And then I saw him on the street a few days later, and he said, well, how come you haven't answered my message? I emailed you a few days ago. And I said, oh, I haven't read that yet. I haven't been online. And he said, well, I happen to know that you did get the message, that you were online because you read the message, and I have software that tells me exactly when you read it at, you know, 3:24 p.m. on Monday afternoon. And I got a receipt to say that you did read it. And I thought, well, at that moment, and this was like 98, that's when I think everything changed, at least in my mind. And that's when I started taking notes about the internet that we had known, which was like AOL and dial-up and messages from your grandmother and a few websites, and changed into this tool of interpersonal surveillance. And that was the point of that lecture to some extent, was to say we can't just blame the big five companies and the surveillance that they do, or the NSA, because we are constantly using these tools on each other and thinking it's okay, whether it's getting email receipts, whether it's parents surveilling their kids, even at college, whether it's spouses surveilling each other through their smartphones, whether it's all the, you know, the spying that people do on each other, whether it's surreptitiously taking photos of each other because it's so easy now. You always have a, you know, high-level camera in your hand. I think that we don't necessarily realize how quickly we've evolved and how quickly we have superseded our idea of our right to privacy by our right to know. And anything that we think that we want to know, where somebody lives, where, what their, you know, unlisted phone numbers, arrest record, anything, all of these things are easily accessible, and there's all kinds of private companies that have set up shop to provide anything we want to know about anybody. And this is not giant tech company doing it or the government doing it. This is the public demand. You know, there's a marketplace for this. And I think that we've just become so comfortable with every level of surveillance and every new low of our intrusion of our privacy. And I, you know, I wrote something that I haven't published just about how tolerant everybody is about every new revelation of the in-home assistance. Like, they say, well, you know, well, of course this machine wouldn't be listening to my conversations. It's just there to tell me the weather. And then we find out that it is listening. And they say, okay, well, as long as it's not humans listening, then that's fine.
As long as it's not recording. Okay, I mean, as long as it's not archiving.
Yeah, well, that would be a different thing. And then we find out not only are they listening, recording, but there's 10,000 people employed to listen to your conversations and ostensibly to improve the software. And then they say, okay, well, as long as it's anonymized and they don't know who I am or whatever, I guess it's okay for me never to know who's listening to what, when the machines can be turned off and on, and they can turn themselves on at any time. And all of these levels of, like, even 15 years ago, if you had were to say that there was a machine that you were going to put in your home voluntarily that would listen to everything you say and store it in a place that you have no knowledge of, no access of, and no control. Nobody would, you know, run to the store to get one of these things. It would seem to be beyond any dystopian fiction. But, of course, there's, you know, hundreds of millions in homes now, partly because we've evolved to the point where we just have no, I think our ideas of what privacy means or our value of it is almost completely gone. I think there's like a few square feet and our skulls that we find that we still retain, like, okay, there's the bathroom, there's the bedroom after a certain hour or whatever, and then there's the space in between our brain, but nothing else. In no other place do we expect privacy. And I think that's a really, you know, radical shift in the, you know, the history of human evolution. And it happened in 10 years.
Do you think that was something that was always true about us and has simply been revealed, that we didn't care about the privacy that much, or it was something that got elicited from us? You've got this nice line in that piece where you say, you know, what happens is we want more information, often information to which we're not actually entitled. I was reading that and thinking about some of these examples that the thing is we endlessly want information that is like actually bad to have, right? Like your friend with the read receipt, like, let that make his life better.
Oh,
you know,
no.
When I'm sitting around being like, well, how many retweets did this get? It's not making my life better. Like nobody throws me a parade for retweets, but I do feel bad if they don't get it, or like somebody else's podcast is, you know, above mine in the rankings. It's like, yeah,
the metrics are really eroding our humanity.
Yeah, you,
I mean, they
all
really
this stuff,
are.
Like, it's, I don't know if it was always in me or it just gets pulled out of me. Like, I think that's what I always wonder about, that is the internet revealing things about us, or is it changing things about us? Like in a kind of Neil Postman, the medium is a message way.
I think the latter, for sure. It's just like if you released a new drug into the world that had been cooked up in a lab, like LSD or whatever, and then you found that they'd that humans had a real, they liked it a lot, and even though it killed them or degraded their lives in some ways, the internet was like that. Something cooked up in a lab. It was a new force, and it's been mutated many times, and many of its iterations or permutations are really bad for us. And there's so many things that are so good for us. It's just that so often we take something good and then we put a surveillance into it. We put the, you know, utter lack of privacy into it. And then and we also put an ugliness somehow ends up into it. And those three things are very surprising to me, given I was around when it started, you know, like, you know, 92, I was 22 and seeing it pop up and email and everything. It just seemed like, oh, that's convenient. I like to be able to send a message to my uncle and he gets it immediately. And, you know, there's so many nice things. And even, but then the metrics part, like who, what kind of twisted mind would think about quantifying how many, you know, and quantifying hearts and quantifying thumbs up and quantifying your friends and the other people's friends in this. The datafication part was so unexpected, at least for me, and I think for some of the hippies that were instrumental in the early days of the internet and who I've met since. And I think a lot of people were just really shocked, like, God, I didn't see all of this, the datafication, the quantifying, the ranking, the numerical assignations to every part of our lives being so quickly embraced.
There are a couple of really fascinating ways in which the way the internet evolved or what it has revealed, I think, defied early expectations. And like this to me is one of the big ones that I remember the early internet too. It's so weird that we're, you know, you're a bit older than me, but not that many. It's going to be crazy that like we are the people who remember a time before the internet, right? Like it's going to, like yeah. My son, like he's going to look at me like a dinosaur. But the internet was supposed to like vault us into this world of the mind beyond like the petty social and geographic and like the petty humanness of it all. Like we were all going to become, you know, like cyborgs. And the thing that is so fascinating to me about the internet is they built these tools and like, well, what's going to make somebody use these? And they're like, well, like what if we let people do social stuff on them? Like we just like start like letting people have friends and hearts and rank, you know, how popular they are. And I don't think anybody had any idea, like not the foggiest idea,
how powerful those drivers of our behavior were. Like I don't think they, I still don't think they actually even quite realize like what it is they're playing with in terms of like identity creation and other things. But just the way that what the internet revealed about us is that if you give me a way to rank how popular I am, like that's it. Like that is the only thing I will do forever. Is just to, like, there you go. Like that's what, you know, that's, we've made life an endless high school cafeteria.
Well, there's also the false comfort of data determinism, you know, to say, well, I mean, and I think Rotten Tomatoes is such a fascinating example and other aggregators of ratings where, you know, a messy, complicated form of art can be reduced to a number. And instead of having to read a bunch of reviews and sort of suss through Pauline Kael's or Anthony Lane's assessment of a movie, you can just go and you see the numerical aggregate. And that somehow, I mean, what's amazing to me is that there is no pushback anywhere about what has been done to film in terms of that being reduced to a metric. And it will come to every other art form for sure. I did that in The Circle, just sort of saying, you know, paintings, of course, are going to be rated and they'll change and be hacked and gamed. But there's this need that we have, a hunger that I don't think everybody saw coming for that comfort that comes from, oh, well, that's a 62. This is a 41. Your credit score is a 702. Your SATs are whatever. The college she went to is ranked at 19. All of these things.
Right, like you ladder all the way up back to our old conversation.
Well, exactly. It used to be kind of like a pretty rare occurrence to see a human being or something created by a human reduced to a number. But now there is nothing that is not numerically assessed. And we have come because it's like wisdom of the crowd. Like, you know, if you have 10,000 ratings on whatever site, it has to have some, you know, accumulated wisdom of all of these people. They must be right. And so if you see, you know, that everybody's favorite work of epic poetry is Beowulf, and it's got a 91.3. Well, that, and from 10,000 people, that there's a certain amount of like, well, that's science. That's just, how do you deny that? There's such a big, large control group of people, and there's a number attached to it. And so we've got that squared away. And now we move on to which play of Shakespeare is the best. And let's do a poll online for that. And it's a real insanely reductive and scary trait. And we are at the very tip of it. It's going to get so much worse. And you know, Kathy O'Neill writes so brilliantly about how this is going to impact and maybe re-stratify or, you know, enforce class stratification, even in a democracy or ostensible classless society like this, where you're born, what zip code, what college, all of these things are going to be, there's going to be numerical aggregates that are going to determine your access to credit, even more so than now, and your experience in life and access to opportunities is going to be really limited by our caterwauling impulse to cede control and decision-making to algorithms. Because we think humans are too fallible, algorithms are infallible, and so more and more we're going to cede decision-making to machines so that we don't make a mistake.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
I read that you don't have Wi-Fi in your house. Is that still true?
Yeah, I never had Wi-Fi. I don't have a smartphone.
No shit.
Oh, no. I've got my flip phone right here on my the table here in the studio. Yeah, it was not going to improve my life in any measurable way, so I never got one.
Yeah, but that's a hard thing to hold. Like, I don't want to just skip that over. Like, that's a hard, like, it's the year of our Lord 2019. Like, you've been holding out for a long time.
Well, I'll borrow them from people if I, like, hey, can I look this up or something? But there's not a lot of tools on a smartphone that would improve my life personally. And I've seen how everyone I know every day wants to throw it against the wall, and they love it and they hate it. And, you know, they have these incredibly complicated relationships with this device. And I think, why would I start, you know, it's like starting heroin or something. Like, what's the upshot of this drug that you're going to be fighting with for the rest of your life? And so my phone makes calls. And it makes, and I can text. It takes me a little while. It's got that predictive text. I don't know what else it does. It has a calculator, so that's good.
Why don't you have Wi-Fi in your house?
Same reason. You know, it's also distracting. You know, I would pretend to be looking something up for research, and then I'd spend the next 2 hours watching, you know, soccer on YouTube. And so I can't be around something so powerfully distracting, and especially since I like to have like an intentionality about a day where it's like, what do I want to do today? Well, I need to do this and I need to do that. Very little of it is going to be done on a Wi-Fi connected laptop. I write on a laptop, but it's never been connected to the internet. It's 13 years old too. And so I don't like that having to update every piece of software that I thought I bought, you know, a decade ago. I sort of like to just buy a piece of software and buy a machine and use it. And so you can see how crotchety I sound.
No, but you know what the thing you actually sound to me is productive.
And yeah, I mean,
The myth, I don't want to call this a myth because I live in it and believe it. The argument that I think most of us accept, even if we have discomfort about where it's all going or how it all feels day to day, is, yeah, it may be fine for like some weird academic or writer or something who, but like for me, like I'm like involved in the world, but you know, you're involved in 826. You've got like these like groups of kids coming together as young leaders. Yeah. You're doing children's books. You've got you've got more stuff going on than most people I talk to. And so how do you, like, I feel the thing that everybody says is that, well, like you got to be able to, people have to be able to reach you. You know, you got to be able to order an Uber. Like,
well,
you're not doing that.
I mean, here, I'm in New York. I take taxis, and the taxi drivers all want to talk about Uber, and we always have a good talk. But, you know, otherwise, I get online in the morning, and usually for about, you know, 10 minutes or so, I get the messages, and then I go offline until 5, and then I get online again, and I send out messages then. And so I'm reachable. You know, I've got to be in touch with the people that run these nonprofits that I try to help and, you know, that we started way back when. And so I'm in touch with a lot of people. And it's just that being forever in touch, you can't write that way. You know, it's to write a novel and be on page 630 of something, you know, it's a deep, deep dive. It takes half the day sometimes just to remember where you are. You know, you're going really far below the surface. And, but if I had a thing dinging next to me constantly, I would stay, you know, I'd be in the shallows the whole time. And so for me, it doesn't work. It can't work. And it's like trying to write in the middle of a circus. And what we forget, though, and, you know, I so admire people that can toggle, but, and when, you know, when I talk to friends who teach in colleges, it's like having a television on the desk when you're in college. Like you're at a lecture, but you've brought a television and you put it on the desk, right? And with the screen facing you. Next to the television is a phone. Like imagine an old type, you know, standard, you know, phone with a receiver and everything. You've set that up next to you. You've set up a little movie theater. You've set up, you know, maybe a stack of letters that you want to answer, all while your professor's trying to talk, right? And the number of sort of, we forget that all of these things are in that little device. It is like the most profound combination of powerful distractions, and it's all in front of you. And I read a really good piece recently about, you know, a professor who banned cell phones in his classroom and how that went, and how the vast majority of the students, even those who were really mad about it at the beginning, ended up thanking him at the end because they were able to kind of have an excuse to be disconnected. And I was on a panel, actually, I moderated a panel of teenagers. This is a panel put on by Common Sense Media. And Jim Steyer and I were the moderators. And talking to five teenagers about their habits, and all we didn't know what they were going to say. We didn't pick them for any particular point of view. All five of them said they were like in a daily existential crisis with their relationship to social media, and none of them had it under control. None of them were sleeping enough. They were sleeping with their phones on their pillow. They had not created a balance. And one of the kids, really incredibly eloquent and passionate young guy, said, you know, they won. These companies won. They've ruined my generation. I give up. And I thought, I came away just so mad at the addictiveness of the tools, the purposely addictive tools, and the way that they do target teenagers and make these devices so appealing to them, and the software and the apps and everything so appealing to them. But I'm also mad at, as a society, the fact that we give these insanely powerful tools to kids too young. Because that was my last question for them. I said, how old should you be? How old would you give yourself a device if you could do it over again? And I think the youngest anybody said was like 16 or never. And they all felt like they'd lost control of their lives because of this device, just like anyone, like an addict would be. And we just have to really come to grips with how powerful they are, how addictive they are. And we've got to stop assuming that kids need these to be connected or need them to be social or need them to do their homework. All of these things are just such obvious fallacies. And we've got to really think about what's best for them and their mental health, and to figure out a new balance, a new plan.
I want to go back to something you said, because look, like I, for all that I'm plugged into everything at all times, I'm very crotchety about it all on the show and have Cal Newport on board. People be like, yeah, like there's Ezra like whining about phones again. But something that I want to go back to, the experience you were talking about of being on page 605 of a novel. So I just finished not a 600-page book and not a novel, but a book. And that experience of once I was far enough in, how much time it took to just get started, how much time it took to rearrange where I was in my own head was a really hard part of it that nobody had prepared me for. And I'd love to hear, as somebody who's written, I don't know, 700 books.
You mean you were writing a book?
I just wrote a book, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
okay.
And I'd love to hear for you what that experience of being very deep in it, like what the experience of being in the depths versus the shallows feels like, what it means, what's different about it, how you get there even.
Well, I recommend to everybody to write a book. It doesn't have to get published, but your brain will change. And I think it's a mind expander for anybody. And I think you improve your mind to such an extent. It is just like a marathon upon marathons intellectually. And it's therapeutic, you know, to write, whether it's your own story or a novel or sci-fi, whatever it is. It is centering. It is calming. It's meditative, you know. And so, you know, these days I spend the first maybe 2 hours reading in the morning, and then I get started usually taking notes on paper for another couple hours. And then in the early afternoon, I start writing passages and something, you know, usually out of order. I don't write in order that often. So I'll write a passage that about some idea that I had that I don't know where it'll fit in, or I have a vague sense of where it'll fit into the novel. But, you know, the whole day is so calm, you know, and, you know, it's weird being in New York where it's so busy, or these last few days, to sort of be thrown into this kind of schedule again, where it's just moving so fast and everybody is, you know, connected at all times. And I feel like I, you know, Rip Van Winkle coming back here, being away for a while. But I don't know if that's helpful. All I know is that, you know, Jaron Lanier, who is a hero of mine, and
yeah, he's amazing. He's been on the show twice.
Oh yeah, he, you know, I think he always explains things better than almost anybody else. I think Kara Swisher explains things really well. Kathy O'Neill is a genius, and Jaron, you know, he would talk about experimenting on yourself. He's like, you know, how do you feel best at the end of the day? Is it being constantly connected? Was that how you know, and I think for a lot of people it is. They're, you know, they somehow make it work, and they're balanced, and it's great. I think for far more people, there isn't that feeling of balance. And how are you going to regain it? And we owe it to ourselves to experiment on ourselves, to feel like, how do you want to live? How do you go to bed at night thinking like, that was it? That was the right experience in life for me, you know? And whether it's, do you have to swim in the ocean every day? Do you have to, you know, spend 2 hours disconnected? You know, Tiffany Schlain just wrote that book about, you know, the tech Shabbat. And so she's figured out that kind of balance. And whatever it is, you have to arrive at a place that you control, that you have made a decision. And I think too many times we think, we've ceded that decision too. Oh God, I could never disconnect for a week because I don't, whatever reason, and or I have to always have the phone on me, or else. I mean, all of these things are fallacies too. We've sort of boxed ourselves in. But I think if you experiment on yourself, like, well, what is the life you want to lead, and get yourself to that place. And for me, you know, I recommend, you know, however you want to do it, but at least a few hours of unconnected time a day. It's just going to recharge you. It's going to allow all of your synapses to, you know, a bit of rest. And you know, I agree with those that say you need to be bored at some point in the day. You need to have extreme downtime. Kids do too. You know, all of these things that have been sort of, you know, proven again and again, and scientists again and again, you know, and pundits and New Age theologians, everybody says the same thing. But we still, I think people still struggle so much with being disconnected for a time. And maybe it comes from a good place where people feel like they want to be accessible and they want to be reached by their loved ones. And I think maybe it's coming from a good place. But, you know, we also have to trust that those loved ones will be there if we don't talk to them for 3 or 4 hours straight. You know, like we've got to regain a sense of proportion and balance.
To reflect the emotional experience here, I came into this interview today, this conversation, just like I had a, like, didn't sleep and like fractured day and running around doing an impeachment podcast and feeling pissed off. Like, why are my days like this? And I got to run from this to something. I find talking to you incredibly calming and grounding. I did not at all expect the particular emotional valence of this conversation to be what it is.
Well, you know, what's weird is that we've been in Spain for a couple months, well, since August. And that is even, I mean, I feel like I don't live like a high stress life in San Francisco, but I have lived a much higher stress life. But these days I'm semi-retired from most of our projects. And like we were talking about, they're run by much more talented people. And but being really one more step removed and living in a village in Spain and really having the days, I just feel like it's really hard to come back to the pace of life here. And but I do feel, you know, that sense like, boy, I do really know what my ideal days look like. And they're a lot simpler than my life was in San Francisco, and a lot simpler than it was 10 years ago. But that's one person, you know, but I think that everybody's got to figure out what is that structure?
There's a funny way in which something I was reflecting on while you were talking is you said a couple of times you have to be able to really look at yourself and say like, well, what felt like a good day? Mm. And I've had the experience for the past couple of years, and it actually came out of a book leave I took we were actually in Half Moon Bay, not far from here. It's part of why we moved out to the West Coast from DC. Mm. And, you know, we're in like a really small place, like really cut off. Like I always think of myself as a super urban person. Mm. And the idea was like everything would be really small, you know, and kind of boring. Yeah. And instead of being small and boring, it felt great. Like it felt bigger. Like there was more space to think. You could like have bigger ideas. You could actually be much more vibrant in your work. And it changed a lot for me personally because what I realized, and I'm not saying I've been able to put this fully into play, but is it my belief about what kind of person I was and what I would like was wrong, right? That like I often live a life as if like, what would I like the book of my life to read like? Uh-huh. Right. You know, like what would, if I was like watching this, like what would I want the character of Ezra to have done? Which is never
done is the key thing.
Right. Which is never to like stay at home and read.
Yeah.
You know, it's always like to go do the cool thing.
Yeah. But well, there's that balance, you know, you do have to do something.
Yeah, maybe. But the thing that I think is interesting, and it goes back to our conversation a couple minutes ago about measures, is that I think for a lot of us, and I certainly feel this, you're one of the things that not just digital life, but a lot of things that you do, pictures on your phone, is it's like have some proof that you had a day, right? That like, you know, I got some stuff done today. You know, I sent out some tweets or everybody liked my photo or whatever it might be. I'm with my son a lot. I have an 8-month-old. And I'll be doing something adorable and I'll like whip out my phone to like capture it for myself or for the future or for my family. And he'll immediately stop doing it because he was doing it with me. And it happens like all the time. And I'm always like, I am the worst. Right. But
it comes from love, you know?
Like, well, or does it come from this desire to, this is a little bit what I'm getting at, that does it come from, it is very hard to force yourself to see how something is really feeling versus like looking at yourself from the outside and trying to measure it all somehow, like trying to like win the competition of your own life as opposed to experience your own life.
You know, there's a balance because obviously we can't all live on a beach from day one till death, you know, like you have to make a living.
Absolutely.
You have to have impact, help people, you know, like make yourself useful. So there's that too. But there's a balance. And I think whatever it is. And, you know, last night I met all kinds of tutors from 826 New York, and they were college students or bank clerks or advertising copywriters. And, you know, for them, tutoring is part of that balance. Like, and again and again, people say, this is the best part of my week is the 2 hours, no phone, because we don't allow the tutors to have phones, like at the table. And it's just a table and two kids. I mean, an adult and a kid and a piece of paper maybe between you. And, you know, that's for them part of that centering, that balance, that kind of like, I need this. This is my humanity bath, you know, this is my, where my soul is replenished, you know, by this young person and their, completely, guileless, approach to life and work. And let's just get this homework done and what a pure, simple thing that is to do and to go home and feel like you got something, you know, something real done. You know, that almost feels better than anything else you can do is to like, you know, get an 8-year-old's homework done. But I do think, you know, we're so much of our, you know, what the technology does is it helps us, or we think we are being we are getting a better measure of how we've used our time on Earth. And part of that is, well, I'm a good parent because I'm taking a lot of pictures and I've documented all the fun we've had, you know, and they're going to be so happy when they're older because I've well documented it, and their peers will have their parents well documenting their time. So I've got to do all, you know, there's that fear of doing it not quite thoroughly enough that I think drives everybody's sort of, you know, obsession with documenting youth. And the same thing with so many of these numerical measurements. It's like, well, I do have this many friends, so that's good. And then I compare them to however many friends other people like me have. All right, it's about right. It gives you all of these kind of false sense of your relationship with the rest of humanity. Are you where you need to be? Are you ranked about the right place that you expect to be? And I think that that's where I think so much of anxiety from teenagers, and you talk about these skyrocketing depression rates and all of these things. I do think that we were not meant to measure ourselves quite as much as is being done, and to think so much about ourselves. There's only so much thinking about yourself you should do on a daily basis. And, or even your family, you know, we are meant to be looking outward, whether it's at the sea or at a problem or, you know, how we can alleviate the suffering of other people or build something lasting and meaningful. There's all of these things, and they don't involve you, you know, and they don't involve your self-documentation or our, you know, measuring how many people liked our last tweet. You know, that feedback loop, the doing something because we've got a certain, you know, kind of reward, also sometimes degrades the essence of why we're doing it, you know?
One thing that brings up that I want to make sure I covered with you in the remainder of our time together is that something that you've done really well in your projects, or that I've thought you've done really well in your projects, like Believer and A26 and others, is the thing that metrics and scale and other things can do is it flattens. It makes everything like everything else. So you're getting bigger, more people get involved, more of the pressures that everybody else is part of. I felt this with things that I've launched, and that, you know, you start with a pretty distinct vision, and part of becoming successful is to become less distinct. And you can see this in very big ways, right? Like Facebook is like, or Google begins with like, don't be evil. And then somebody's like, I mean, like not too evil, like, don't be too evil.
Right.
And I'm curious how you've, in the same way that it seems like you've stood in your own life against a lot of pressures of the age, just like how you've stood as you've built things against what I'm sure have been a lot of offers to take them big in ways that would have made them a lot less like themselves.
Yeah, you know, early on, I realized the tension between art and scale and integrity and scale. Every so often, you can do something on a large scale exactly as you want to do it. And that happens for sure in film. And, you know, if you write for The New Yorker, there's a massive audience and it's, you know, brilliantly edited. And it has, I think, the highest integrity. And I'm sure that's what you're trying to do at Vox, too, is retain that integrity and reach as many people who will want to read that as possible without you having to compromise it. And that's the ideal thing. But you often find that there's a ceiling. And the Believer's ceiling was relatively low. The McSweeney's ceiling was relatively low. We didn't have any capital ever to like buy subscribers or, you know, to expand, to roll the dice. It was always every subscriber helped pay for a few more copies that we printed. And it always grew organically that way. But it's a tough thing when you realize, like, God, I guess the audience for this literary magazine will never exceed 10,000 people. And you realize that that's it. Unless, I guess, some, you know, you pour $10 million into rolling the dice and seeing if there's more people out there for it. But in our case, you know, that was some years ago I came to that you know, conclusion and was at peace with it. And the editors of The Believer, Heidi Julewitz and my wife, Vendela, and Ed Park, and they also had to come to grips with the ceiling of the audience and say, like, well, these 5,000 or 10,000 readers are really good readers. They're super engaged. They care a lot. They write letters. They're very loyal. and it has a value in the world. And that value might not be scalable, and it might stay, you know, at that circumscribed place. But then you might work on something else that has a wider mainstream appeal. I think that that sort of mix is important too. But knowing what the limit is for a certain project or a certain work of art, that it's going to have a certain limited audience unless you, you know, and that would leave you if you changed it, and that you would, you can't compromise the people that actually understand that work for those that that aren't going to, that even if you changed it, compromised it, diluted it, you might not even, you're going to lose both sides. You're going to lose the people loyal to you, and you might not attain anything else. It's like the dog looking at his reflection in the water and dropping the bone in his mouth in hopes of getting the one reflected back at him, and he loses both. But I think, you know, now, you know, you guys are in an interesting spot. I guess the merge with New York Magazine, I think I was hearing about in the lobby, which, and you're in a spot of growth. And so that's the fun place, you know, just let it grow and see where it goes. And always remember that you'll know the very moment when your loyal audience isn't with you anymore. And holding on to them is everything. And holding on to that place where people really say, like, okay, that's a place where I'm going to be told something that nobody else is telling me. They're going to tell it to me in an interesting way. And they're not going to succumb to, you know, clickbait or change their ways of doing things because the metrics say this or that. You know, I think that, you know, that's always been the tension with any kind of media, whether it's ratings or, you used to call it CPM, you know, cost per thousands of readers, all of these different things. There's always been some sort of metric in media, but you have to trust, as the New York Times and the Washington Post and the New Yorker, all of these places that have gotten better during this time of, you know, mass media dilution, they've actually gotten better. And so sometimes you actually have to zig when everybody's zagging and make your product better and heighten the integrity at a time when it's being degraded elsewhere.
I feel like I honestly could ask you questions and listen to you give like thoughtful, peaceful answers for hours, but unfortunately I'm going to have to wrap us. So let me ask you the question I always used to end, which is, what are three books you've read that have had an effect on you that you would recommend to the audience?
You know, I'm just going to go with what I've been reading recently, because I've been just plowing through Edith Wharton. And I'd read, you know, Ethan Frome years ago, but misread that novel. And so I have this collection that has four of her novels, and I'm through three of four, on to Age of Innocence next. But I feel like I was deprived the fact that I did not know her work that well earlier. I started with Custom of the Country, which is just a insanely brilliant and satire of the Belle Epoque and sort of social climber in New York and Paris in the turn of the century, previous century. And it is so funny and so beautifully written and so such a scalpel sharp satire of that time. And then I read House of Mirth, which I loved a lot, but not as much. And it's not as funny, but still beautifully written. Then Ethan Frome, I totally misread before. And it's so different than the other two books, but perfect in its way. And so I'm on to Age of Innocence next. But these are, I have to chalk it up to a certain amount of sexism that her reputation isn't even bigger than it is, even though she's well known. I think that she is the equal of almost any American prose writer, and should have the readership of Jane Austen and Hemingway and Faulkner and everybody else. So I think if anybody wants a really incredibly entertaining and rich and novel, run to Custom of the Country.
Dave Eggers, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ezra.
Thank you to Dave Eggers. I'm going to go throw my phone out the window. thank you to you for being here. I know we talked about how metrics are bad, but the only metric that is good is rating the show on Apple Podcasts so other people can find it. Just doesn't matter what you say. We don't care about the metric, just the discovery. Although, you know what? The important thing is that we have you here who are true fans and nobody else really matters. I think that's the lesson. Thank you to Cynthia Gill for engineering, to Roger Karma for researching, to Jeffrey Geld for producing. Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast network production. And my email, as always, is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com.